Welcome to the second lecture on critical human rights in the Spanning the Century series. The first was the Dorab Patel lecture, which was held in February. What could be more critical than the use of force by NATO on behalf of human rights in Kosovo? We are privileged to welcome Professor Adam Roberts to talk about the protection of human rights and the use of force, the case of Kosovo. Professor Adam Roberts is the Montague Burton Professor of International Relations at the University of Oxford. There is probably nobody better qualified to talk on this subject. He's been writing about the use of force and international law, and indeed about Yugoslavia, for many years. He wrote a book on Yugoslav called Nations in Arms, The Theory and Practice of Territorial Defense. He has also edited a book on the documents on the laws of war. The second edition was published in 1989, and a third edition is in press as we speak. He's also written on civil resistance in East European and Soviet revolutions, on Hugo Grotius and international relations, where he edited a book with Hedley Bull and Benedict Kingsbury. He's written on the United Nations in a book edited with Benedict Kingsbury called The United Nations Divided World, The UN's Role in International Relations. And he has written on humanitarian action in war, aid, protection, and impartiality in a policy vacuum. We're very pleased to be able to welcome him here this evening to talk about the protection of human rights and the use of force. Adam.
I must begin on a sad note. Today, Derek Fatched MP, who was a Minister of State in the Foreign Office, died. He was an alumnus of this school and a former research officer of this school, and all those who knew him in his Foreign Office role, where he had responsibilities, among other things, areas of Asia, and also he had the responsibility of conducting some of the government's briefings on Kosovo, and did so as recently as last Saturday, we'll remember him as somebody who was both thoughtful and approachable, and who was indeed a very effective Foreign Office minister. And I can't begin this lecture without recalling my sadness at this very sudden an unexpected death. My pleasure in coming back to LSE is tempered by memories of teaching two completely incompatible subjects at this school, which I still find myself teaching. On the one hand, strategic studies, and on the other hand, some aspects of international law. And I can assure you it's a recipe for terrible mental indigestion. And you may have some evidence of that in what you are about to hear. The war over Kosovo exposes and gives urgency to a perennial and enduring question in international relations. Is it ever justified to intervene forcefully against a state on account of its violations of human rights and humanitarian norms in its own territory? And that's the heart of the question, I believe, raised by the Kosovo crisis. The increasing emphasis on human rights has been a striking feature of international relations in the post-Cold War era. Treaties in the field and treaties on international law applicable in armed conflict have not only been negotiated and accepted by a very large number of states, but they've featured increasingly in the diplomacy and resolutions of the United Nations. What then is to happen when the provisions of those treaties, laboriously negotiated, are openly and massively violated? Can that be a possible basis for using force, or is war an improper and inappropriate instrument for responding to such crises? The focus of what I'm going to say is based quite largely on events on and since the 24th of March of this year. This was a doubly significant day for human rights in international relations. It was the day of the Pinochet decision of the House of Lords, a landmark in the evolution of the idea that there are some standards so basic that they must apply across the board, even to heads of government, even in countries which have limited or no connection with the original where the original offence was conducted. And on that very same day, Operation Allied Force was launched, the NATO campaign in respect of Kosovo. And that operation was announced at the start as being based on the idea, very close to the one in the Pinochet decision, that there are some crimes so extreme that a state responsible for them, despite the principle of sovereignty, may properly be the subject of military intervention. Now, the international human rights movement, composed of a huge array of individuals, NGOs, intergovernmental bodies, and so on, has been deeply divided over Operation Allied Force. This divided reaction is not surprising. The human rights movement's naturally unhappy about human rights and international humanitarian law being a basis for initiating war. This war's declared aims have been to protect Kosovars and to enable them to return home in safety, aims which must certainly invite sympathy. Yet so far, the NATO campaign has failed to prevent and has almost certainly exacerbated extremes of violence against the Kosovars. And, especially in the last few days, it has led to a serious worsening of international relations. On 30th of April, Mary Robinson, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, indicated her unhappiness about the bombing on the basis of the number of civilians killed and civilian installations targeted. But at the same time, she made very clear her concern about the huge scale of the ethnic cleansing in Kosovo, which is, of course, of a far greater size than the deaths as a result of the bombing. Today, in a statement in Montenegro, she has sharply criticized the bombing and has said that its humanitarian objectives have failed. And likewise, Jiří Dienstbier, a former Czechoslovak foreign minister, has last week heavily criticised the bombing. I want to address five questions about all of this. Firstly, is the NATO action over Kosovo legitimate under international law? Secondly, what are the stated purposes of the bombing campaign? Thirdly, why has there been such heavy reliance on air power? Fourthly, does the NATO action have a prospect of achieving a successful outcome? And fifthly, what can be learned about responding to massive human rights violations? In addressing these questions, I will put particular emphasis on statements made by British ministers. And this isn't because of an exclusive concern with what happens in Britain or a belief that we are the most important. It is purely for illustrative purposes, to focus. I was actually, it so happens, in the United States, in Washington, on the day the bombing began, and I could equally well have taken examples from the United States debate, beginning with the announcement, which was the first thing I saw on American TV about it, on the TV news program in Washington, that NATO has gone into action in the Baltics today. a terrifying indication of that geographical isolation and ignorance which occasionally is in evidence in the States. The first question, is the NATO action over Kosovo legitimate under international law? I want to address here the question of jus ad bellum, the legitimacy of the resort to force, and not the equally important, but separate and complex, question of the application of the laws of war to NATO's use of force. On this, I should just say the obvious, that the NATO action is subject to the provisions of the laws of war, and that it accepts that this is so, and that many questions are raised about whether aspects of the NATO bombing, which has in general been discriminate, but with some terrible and well-known disasters, do go beyond what the existing law allows. And in particular, there are concerns about the environmental consequences of the bombing, about its huge impact on Serbian society generally, and about the destruction of cultural sites. The NATO action is as fully subject to the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia as is anything that is done by any Yugoslav, Slobodan Milosevic included. And that was a point that was emphasized by Mary Robinson in her remarks in Montenegro today. The rightness or otherwise of the original resort to force is an issue that exposes very sharp divisions of opinion. Some critics of the action have termed it aggression and a violation of the UN Charter. The Federal Republic of Yugoslavia has taken a case to the International Court of Justice, and today was the first day of hearings on provisional measures. And those of you with long memories at LSE will remember that Ian Brownlee used to be Professor of International Law here, and now Professor Christopher Greenwood is. And in that spirit of LSE, where every side of every issue has to be heard, Professor Brownlee, I believe, is representing the Serbian cause, the Yugoslav cause, in the International Court of Justice, and Professor Greenwood is arguing against him. So anything I say is subject to the wiser decision that will eventually come, or may eventually come, or at least possible decision on the interim measures question from the hearings which begin today. Now, ministers from the NATO governments have repeatedly sought to justify the action on two basic grounds, which are interrelated. On the day the bombing began, George Robertson said, "We think there's sufficient authority in existing Security Council resolutions, and indeed the use of force in international law can be justified as an exceptional measure to prevent an overwhelming humanitarian catastrophe." Those are his words before the House of Commons Select Committee on Defence on the 24th of March. It's certainly true that UN Security Council resolutions did make very specific demands with which the parties, and especially the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, did not fully comply. And Resolution 1199 of September last year famously demanded that Yugoslavia cease all action by the security forces affecting the civilian population and order the withdrawal of security units used for civilian repression. And the same resolution endorsed proposals of the contact group and referred to possible further action if the measures demanded in the resolution were not taken. So that is the main resolution prayed in aid of the use of force. However, as you all know, the Security Council has not been willing to take the logical next step and authorize a NATO military campaign against Yugoslavia in respect of Kosovo. It has been crystal clear, and is even more so now, that Russia and China would veto any resolution that might be proposed seeking such an authorization. Thus, the NATO powers were placed in the unenviable position, which they themselves had created, of either doing nothing in military terms when Milosevic openly flouted the terms of NATO assurances and Security Council resolutions, or of taking action themselves and without Security Council approval. The absence of Security Council resolution in this case is serious, especially as any international legal concept of humanitarian intervention is, to put it mildly, highly contested. In the 1990s, there have been episodes of such intervention in a state, but in most cases, they've had the specific approval of the Security Council. There was such authorization in Somalia in 92, Rwanda in 94, and Haiti the same year. There was no such formal authorization in the case of the establishment of the safe havens in northern Iraq in 91. There, as over Kosovo, a resolution proclaimed what it sought to achieve, which in that case was immediate access by international humanitarian organizations, but it did not authorize military means to attain that end. And that's the position, that was the position when the US military, or US-led military action began in northern Iraq on 17 April 91. And that action was tolerated by the international community, I believe, partly because there was a clear congruence between means and ends, and it enabled refugees to return home, back across the border. While many treaties negotiated at the UN enshrine human rights and lay down standards that states must follow, the awkward fact remains that there is no general license to humanitarian intervention in the UN Charter, nor in any treaty or UN resolution. Nor is there the slightest possibility of getting agreement in the UN on the general principle of humanitarian intervention. Different states simply view the matter from different perspectives. For those like myself who view the UN as having a primary but not an exclusive responsibility in international security issues, this conclusion doesn't rule out completely the legitimacy of a particular case of humanitarian intervention. If there is any such right of humanitarian intervention, it's essentially not UN-based, but something that can be inferred from the practice of states acting in urgent crises and from the responses of other states to that practice. And many states, in initiating military actions in the post-1945 period, have used an element of humanitarian intervention in their justification. That was the case, for example, with the Indian liberation of Bangladesh after the disasters in Pakistan. If UN authorization for a particular action is not forthcoming, as it clearly isn't in this case, weight is bound to be given to whether a particular action nevertheless gains the support of a significant group of states, for example, on a regional basis. The fact that all members of the NATO Council approved the military action in this case is itself persuasive that the operation is not simply one state or a small group of states acting without reference to international considerations and norms. And this humanitarian justification was put in strong personal terms by the Foreign Secretary in the debate in the House of Commons on the 25th of March, the second day of the bombing. And I'll read it because it conveys a strong sense of the essence of the case for what has gone on. Since March last year, well over 400,000 people in Kosovo have at some point been driven from their homes. This is about a fifth of the total population. In Britain, the equivalent would be over 10 million people. I defy any member to meet the Kosovar Albanians, to whom I've talked repeatedly over the past 3 months, and tell them that we know what is being done to their families, that we see it every night on television in our own homes, that in the region we have a powerful fleet of Allied planes, and yet that although we know this and have the power to intervene, we have chosen not to. Not to have acted when we knew the atrocities that were being committed would have made us complicit in the repression. Now, lawyers, of whom I am not one, tend to like a world of clarity, where an action can be clearly defined and categorized as legal or illegal. Politicians and members of the public around the world look to law to provide clear guidance, or at least a verbal bludgeon with which to assault their opponents. In reality, because contradictory legal principles are inescapably at the heart of this crisis, there is no definitive legal answer that will satisfy the majority of people or the majority of governments. Law does not provide absolute answers in this case. Now, there are, I must stress, other strands in NATO's rationale for resorting to bombing, and credibility was one of them. As, again, quoting Robin Cook in the House of Commons, the awareness of atrocities wasn't the only reason we acted. He said, "Our confidence in our peace and security depends on the credibility of NATO. Last October, NATO guaranteed the ceasefire that Milosevic signed. He has comprehensively shattered that ceasefire. What possible credibility would NATO have next time that our security was challenged if we did not honour that guarantee? The consequences of NATO inaction would be far worse than the consequences of NATO action." So, as so often in life, a number of distinct motives are overlaid on top of each other, and that credibility one I believe to have been important. In short, NATO's decision to use force doesn't have anything like as clear an endorsement in international law as its governments might wish, but equally, it's not in clear violation of international law. Indeed, a Russian attempt on the 26th of March to get the Security Council to demand an immediate end to NATO's air attacks was defeated by 12 votes to 3, unintentionally giving some degree of legitimacy to the action that had begun 2 days before. If there's some force in the legal arguments that have been used in support of this operation, that conclusion must be subject to four caveats. First, since neither argument, neither the humanitarian argument nor the Security Council resolution argument, gives an incontestable and legally watertight basis for the NATO action, it's in the nature of things that different individuals and states will see it differently. This being so, the question of the means pursued by NATO to secure the ends proclaimed must inevitably affect judgments about the legality of the operation. Secondly, there are dangers in the argument that NATO has a general right and duty to act as vigilante for the implementation of United Nations resolutions. Exactly the same element of rationale appeared in some Egyptian statements at the initiation of the 1973 Middle East War. NATO isn't the only institution that can take the law into its own hands in the name of international resolutions. Thirdly, there must, of course, and inevitably be arguments about the selectivity of actions by NATO, just as there are always arguments about the selectivity of actions by the UN. And in particular, the question, why act over Kosovo when we did so very little to stop the Croatian government's ethnic cleansing of Serbs from the Krajina in 1995, is a question that Serbs naturally advance. This episode has been conveniently expunged from our collective memories, but not from the collective memory of Serbs. Fourthly, there's a problem which seems to have stalked all interventions with a basically humanitarian purpose in the 1990s. And that problem is that the Western powers that are willing to intervene militarily are reluctant to accept the risk of casualties. This leads to particular modes of operation, to hesitant and temporary military interventions, to having exit strategies before you've entered. And of course it leads to bombing from 15,000 feet. Now to the stated purposes of the bombing campaign. The particular question that this use of air power raises is whether air power can possibly serve a humanitarian purpose in the midst of a civil war. Can it stop ethnic cleansing? And this question has two main aspects. Can it actually protect vulnerable peoples from assault? And secondly, can it cause the regime instigating mass killings and expulsions to change its mind? In the crisis in 1998 over Kosovo, The threat of air power was explicitly made to Milosevic as a means of inducing him to comply with the demands of the contact group and the UN Security Council. Yet when Operation Allied Force began, it was presented to an extraordinary extent that surprised me when I went back and read all the statements at the time as an operation to protect Kosovars from assault. On the day the campaign started, George Robertson, addressing the House of Commons Select Committee on Defence, reminded MPs that the number of Serb forces in Kosovo had drastically increased in violation of an agreement reached the previous October. And he then stated, "Our military objective, our clear, simple military objective, will be to reduce the Serbs' capacity to repress the Albanian population and thus to avert a humanitarian disaster." He did, to be fair, state that the refugee problem would grow. But then he was asked specifically by a member of the Select Committee on Defence, Mike Hancock MP, "With 50,000 Serb soldiers in or around Kosovo, once we attack, the opportunity for them to give instant payback to the Kosovars is obviously a very great incentive on their part. What's the plan to safeguard the interest of these Kosovars?" He got no answer. And when the question was repeated, George Robertson merely stated, "We would clearly take that into account if that was the situation," which must be the politician's all-purpose answer to absolutely any question. Another member of the Select Committee, Crispin Blunt MP, who warned that the NATO action might make the clearance in Kosovo more bloody, got equally short shrift. Then in response to a question from Laura Moffat MP, George Robertson said, "Our targets are military and do not involve civilian or urban targets. This is a message that will get through despite the fact that the media is state-owned and controlled. If military action has to be taken, it will be taken only with precision-guided weapons, and it will be taken only against military targets, and with a very clear objective, not to bomb common sense or even self-interest in the mind of President Milosevic, but to reduce the military capability that is being used against a civilian population." Absolute clarity about a limited and clear aim. Shortly afterwards, the chairman said, "Having clarified their legal status, I presume there will be no formal declaration of war." To which Robertson replied, "It is not a war." He indicated, as did President Clinton and others that day, that there was no plan for a land-air campaign over Kosovo. And he said, "NATO has ruled that out." Now, much that Mr. Robertson said that fateful day was sensible, and his recognition that we cannot have a casualty-free war was an implicit acceptance that we were getting into something very like war. He did recognize that whether or not you called it war, the Geneva Conventions and so on would apply. Nothing that he said was egregious by the standards of the NATO countries at the time. But it's hard to avoid a harsh judgment. The campaign began in an atmosphere of absurd and manifestly unwarranted official optimism, both about the capacity of bombing to protect the Kosovars and the probability that it would stay limited, coupled with an extraordinary pretense that NATO's action was not war. Since then, following the bombing's failure to stop the terrible events in Kosovo, the aims of the bombing have broadened. While NATO political leaders have not offered any really well-considered full-length explanation of the war, Tony Blair's speech in Chicago on the 22nd of April comes pretty close. And in the course of addressing numerous topics in that speech, he said, "This is a just war, based not on any territorial ambitions, but on values. We cannot let the evil of ethnic cleansing stand. We must not rest until it is reversed." And he then spelt out NATO's 5 objectives, which I'm sure will be familiar to you all. He then went on to say, famously, "Success is the only exit strategy I am prepared to consider." Then, in addressing the subject of global interdependence, a subject on which I'm sure a good deal has been said in these halls. He said, globalization is not just economic, it's also a political and security phenomenon. We are all internationalists now, whether we like it or not. We cannot turn our back on conflicts and the violation of human rights within other countries if we want to be secure. This, I'm sorry to say, is in a long and deplorable tradition of that kind of internationalism that consists of little more than the hope that the rest of the world can be more like us. Furthermore, this statement might seem to be a recipe for universal intervention, especially with the throwing in, for good measure, to an American audience, of John Kennedy's crusading and fateful statement, the meaning of which I have never understood, that freedom is indivisible. Blair did propose five considerations about how to decide when and whether to intervene, each of which was in the form of a question. On one of these questions, and only one, he didn't even outline an answer, and that was the critical question. Third, it was his third question, on the basis of a practical assessment of the situation, are there military operations that we can sensibly and prudently undertake? And this is a question that still needs a measured answer. And it leads me to the question of why there's been such a heavy reliance on air power. How has it come to pass that the ancient and ever-contested idea of humanitarian intervention has come to be associated with bombing? How is it that Cook, in that statement of his in the House of Commons, referred to a powerful fleet of Allied planes as the solution to the problem? In the long history of legal debates about humanitarian intervention, which go back to the 19th century, there's been a consistent failure to address directly the question of the methods used in such intervention. It is almost as if the labelling of an intervention as humanitarian provides sufficient justification in itself that there's no need to think any further about the aims of the operation or the means employed, or to understand the society in which the intervention occurs. In the 1990s, a high price has been paid for the failure to address seriously the question of means and purposes in several interventions, including in Somalia, where there was no clear object and troops in several contingents engaged in torture and other shocking practices. The idea that air power can be the means of implementing the decisions of the international community has a long and peculiar history. In 1944 and 45, when the UN Charter was being drawn up, and before we had learnt some sobering truths about the effects of bombing during the Second World War, both the Western Allies and the Soviet Union had a vision of the will of the international community being imposed by air power. One result was a little-known article in the UN Charter, Article 45, which states that members shall hold immediately available national air force contingents for combined international enforcement action. Well, they haven't exactly observed that particular article of the UN Charter very faithfully, but belatedly and without UN blessing, we have been seeing the idea behind that charter vision implemented over Kosovo. Why, in the particular case of Kosovo, has there been such an extraordinary reliance on air power? Many airmen, including in the Royal Air Force, are very well aware of the limits of what air power on its own can achieve. The pressure to use air power has, I believe, come from elsewhere. Apart from all the psychological explanations that can be offered, two more mundane explanations for the degree of reliance on air power suggest themselves. The first is that NATO is simply not willing to risk lives in any significant number in this operation. Air power, as over Iraq in 1991, is relatively risk-free. Second, there may be a false reading of the history of the Bosnian War, which has led to an excessive degree of reliance on air power. It's perfectly possible that the NATO bombing campaign which began at the end of August 1995 and attacked Serb targets in Bosnia, contributed something to Serb weakness and the eventual willingness to accept a less than ideal solution at Dayton. However, the mythologizing about that campaign has ignored one inconvenient fact, and that is that that campaign followed a series of very severe Serb reverses in military engagements on the ground, and it followed the mass expulsion of Serbs from the Croatian Krajina. That mass expulsion knocked the self-confidence out of Serbs, both in Bosnian Serbdom and in Serbia proper, more than any other single act in the war. The real lesson of those events might be a very different one. Not that bombing works, but that if NATO wants to have some effect, it needs to have allies among the local belligerents. But to go in that direction takes one off the high moral pedestal of humanitarian intervention and into a nasty world of moral compromises of one kind or another. The emphasis on air power, coupled with a reluctance to risk lives of servicemen, has led to bombing from 15,000 feet with inevitable errors in acquiring and attacking targets. Those errors can be overstated and have naturally been played for all they're worth by Serb television. They do not begin to compare in any grim comparison of losses with the effects of the ethnic cleansing in Kosovo. Yet there are moral problems involved in the whole idea of the low-risk waging of war. It can lead to moral callousness, carelessness in the choice of a target, and it can have the obvious result that if the initiators of the bombing cannot be attacked, the recipients of the bombing take vengeance on easy victims closer to home. The Western statements about this military action have shown astonishingly little understanding of the way Serbs think about their country and about its defence. From all the Western official statements about the war, one would hardly guess that Serbia is one of the most multi-ethnic, perhaps even the most multi-ethnic, of the republics of the former Yugoslavia, or that the mentality of the Serbs is not one to make a cost-benefit analysis of the bombing. Rightly or wrongly, Serbs tend to see Serbia as having seen off the Ottomans in the early 19th century and the Austrians in the First World War. They see Yugoslavia as having stood alone against Hitler in 1941 and against Stalin from 1948 to 53. A people with the image of themselves as suffering courageously in a deeply hostile world, and a people who feel a personal obligation to defence, were never likely to crumple quickly in the face of a bombing campaign alone. Serbia, of course, is deeply demoralised and divided today, but the problem is undoubtedly not Milosevic alone. It is a problem of a national psyche, and any of you who have seen the recent rerun of the Fall of Yugoslavia television programme, Death of Yugoslavia television programme, with those early shots of Milosevic pandering to mass Serb opinion in and about Kosovo, will know that it isn't a problem of Milosevic alone, but of those forces that he leads. Even after the evidence of Serb obduracy, the NATO alliance was unable to come up with any strategy other than the fateful more of the same, which is bound to lead to further disasters as the initial lists of military targets are exhausted. The humanitarian intervention in Kosovo increasingly looks like the reductio ad absurdum of the whole idea of humanitarian intervention. The fourth question: does the NATO action have a prospect of achieving a successful outcome? Being a student of international relations does not give one a crystal ball. Very small events can have huge consequences, as witness the possibility that a wrong digit in a code sent the missile to the wrong building in Belgrade, or as witness the fact that a chauffeur taking a wrong turn by mistake in Sarajevo in 1914 led to events the consequences of which we are still facing. I have no simple prediction and no simple prescription to offer. Democracies tend to begin their wars in muddle and confusion with early humiliations and setbacks, and this war is certainly no exception. To presume that air power could protect the Kosovars or lead to an early change of mind by the Yugoslav government was grossly optimistic. To explicitly rule out the use of ground forces, and I recognise the extreme difficulties of using ground forces in Kosovo, was to enable Milosevic to go about his business undisturbed. Granted that this war was started under uninspiring leadership and in the wrong way, it's natural that many believe it should be stopped before it gets worse, that NATO should stop the bombing, get whatever settlement it can, and retire to lick its wounds. The certainty that there will be serious political fallout in several key NATO countries in respect of this war reinforces such a conclusion, as does the ominously hostile approach of Russia and China. Today, the President of China, Jiang Zemin, has said that the UN Security Council cannot discuss any peace plans until NATO stops the bombing. To call a halt now would indeed show respect for Dennis Healey's famous law of holes. When you're in a hole, don't go on digging it. That's a view which I must confess I have considerable sympathy for. However, the dilemmas we face offer no easy way out of Healey's hole. Against an immediate cessation is the possibility that a unilateral cessation of military activities now would compound our earlier betrayals of Kosovo, including the betrayal of excluding it from the 1995 Dayton negotiations. It would leave huge numbers of Kosovo refugees stranded without any prospect of going home in safety. It would leave unreversed a particularly vicious case of ethnic cleansing, and it would mean that UN Security Council resolutions, NATO assurances, and a great deal of human rights law and the law of war would have a considerable job to regain the credibility that they had hoped they once had. It remains possible that whether or not the bombing continues now, the best hope may be a negotiated solution along the lines agreed by the G8 last week before the attack on the Chinese embassy on the 7th of May, which called so much into question. If any such settlement is to mean anything, there will have to be a very strong commitment from outside powers to remain in Kosovo for as long as it takes to guarantee the security of returning refugees. And any such settlement will have to be negotiated with the President Milosevic, who, to judge by his statement today, suspects that this is a good time for him to be entering into negotiations, and when he may have certain advantages. Such a settlement would have been more a satisfactory settlement would have been more likely to be reached on favourable terms if there had been some serious prospect of military action on the ground in Kosovo. Land war, or the credible threat thereof, was more likely than anything else to lead to an outcome which contains at least some satisfactory elements. But NATO from the start has shown that classic problem of the large international organisation, its inability to agree on more than the lowest common denominator. NATO members, even a coalition of the willing within NATO, had to be prepared for land operations if anything was to be rescued from this ill-considered action. Arming the Kosovo Liberation Army was another possible action or option, but it was likely to require changing the terms of the UN embargo on arms for Yugoslavia, something that would now be very difficult to achieve following the bombing of the Chinese embassy. In short, whatever the outcome, and I think there is a prospect for some kind of fudged outcome under United Nations auspices, I have the nasty feeling that Serbia and NATO will have one thing in common at the end of this campaign, that they will both associate Kosovo with defeat. A few words about what might be learned about responding to massive human rights violations. Firstly, There is an alternative model of how human rights can affect dictatorships, what I might call the Helsinki model. The quiet upholding of human rights norms, combined with a process of security dialogue, can have considerable effect and was one of the contributory causes of the 1989 revolutions in Eastern Europe. Secondly, the question of whether military intervention is ever justified remains. I'm suspicious of the label of humanitarian intervention, as you may have gathered. It implies a self-congratulation about motive and purpose. It implies a blithe assumption that the methods will be as humanitarian and the purposes, and it may be that the term needs to be used with more discrimination than it has sometimes in the past. But nonetheless, the underlying problem remains of whether, in exceptional cases, a military response is justified. And the answer, I think, has to be that in exceptional cases, yes, it may be, if it can afford actual protection and if it involves ground forces, as in northern Iraq in 91 without UN blessing, or with Haiti in 94 with it. Bombing may have some role in such activities, as arguably in the no-fly zones in northern and southern Iraq, but cannot be the sole basis of action. Thirdly, there's a need to be honest and to recognize that military action can sometimes make a disaster worse. All major cases of genocide and ethnic cleansing in this century have occurred during or immediately after wars, and the chaos and hatred unleashed in war can provide the necessary conditions for such mass cruelty. Sometimes there may be a need to accept something that our age finds hard to accept, tragedy. There can be situations which cannot be put right by outside military action, or if they are put right, only at very great cost and expense, including in human lives. Lastly, Western tendencies to engage in vast generalizations about the global reach of human rights, about the indivisibility of freedom, and about globalization all serve the dismal function of concealing the enduring truth that different societies have different values, different security fears, and different views about the rights of the sovereign state. The most misleading aspect of the ethical foreign policy much proclaimed in this country is the pretense that it is entirely new and that the ethical dilemmas addressed haven't been addressed before, and that there's nothing to learn from the past. The need for a bit less bombast and rhetoric and a bit more prudence are lessons that are likely to be learned from Operation Allied Force. Thank you.
Professor Roberts has kindly agreed to answer questions. There are microphones both in the balcony and downstairs. Can you please state your name once you have the microphone? And in the interests of having as many people as possible participate, can you please keep your remarks short and your questions brief? Question over there. I'll just wait for the mic.
Jim Addington from Renew UN. My question may be a slightly unusual one, but I think it has great bearing. Most of the audience here, I think, are not students of international relations, and I think I'm right in saying the speaker is not a psychologist. But one thing that has puzzled me and worried me for some weeks now is the way in which certain parts of the population of this country appear to have wholeheartedly endorsed the war, almost as if they have something inside them, some sort of atavistic feelings. And these certainly were expressed at the beginning of the First World War. which everybody knew was coming from probably 5 or 10 years ahead. Have you any comment to make on our sort of mindset that seems to bring this about?
I don't detect in this country any particular sense of relishing this war or viewing it as a particularly heroic episode. It seems to be accepted fatefully, and I have to say I think the British public does in general take a view which has been evident in the Falklands War in 1982 and in the Gulf War in 1991 and in a number of other occasions, that this is a rough, tough world, and sometimes it is necessary to fight to prevent attacks, aggression, violations of human rights or whatever, and there's some degree, I think, of legitimate pride in the professionalism of our armed forces in carrying out the tasks they've been given. And I don't regard these as evidence of any great psychological fault. So I'm not convinced that there's some deep atavistic love of war. And in the particular events that we have been watching, I think the public has been more aware of and concerned about the hideous refugee issue, and is aware that to some extent at least that may be a consequence of the use of force, and that that has further tended to dampen any euphoria there might have been about this action. So I don't altogether share the implied view that you put forward.
Mary Caldor, LSC. I wanted to thank you for a really terrific lecture, which wonderfully clarified the issues, I thought. I wanted to make a comment and ask a question. The comment is just, I think that another reason for this obsession with bombing comes out of history and tradition, the history of deterrence, and the fact that this is what the US Armed Forces know about how to do, and there's always a tendency for generals to fight the last war. I was very struck at the beginning of the war when they were hoping to get Milosevic's compliance, this idea of the idea of the shot across the bows was so reminiscent of the cruise missile strategy of the 1980s. That's just a comment. It just adds to your points. The question is about ground troops. You said you thought the best hope was an agreement. You also said that you might use ground troops, as in northern Iraq and Haiti. And you also said it was a tragic mistake not to rule out the use of ground troops at the beginning. What do you think about ground troops now in the event that there's not an agreement? And particularly, I'd ask you that in the light of all your work on territorial defense and the argument that the Yugoslav army, this is what the Yugoslav army knows how to defend itself against.
On your comment, I think it is true that there has been a culture of fascination with the precision of cruise weapons and all of that. But it only requires a moment's thought to reach the conclusion that even in the case of Iraq, where they had a huge array of advantages, air power on its own could not remove Iraq from Kuwait, and a land war was necessary. There's no evidence at all from events then or subsequently that air power on its own could have achieved that objective. And incidentally, although you're right that there has in some quarters been a sort of culture of fascination with air power and a belief that at last the mad theories advanced by the Italian Due in the 1930s might come true, I don't think it's true, certainly not uniformly, of Air Force service chiefs. Certainly not true in this country, and I don't think necessarily true in the United States. Many of them are well aware of the limits of what air power can achieve. And after this episode is over and the inquiries take place, one very serious inquiry that will have to take place will be about what military advice governments were given and whether they listened to it and whether they excluded significant advice from that equation. Mary Kaldor's second question, and much the harder one, is about ground forces and what they might do, what they might achieve, and what the risks would be of serious Yugoslav territorial defense operating against them. Now, firstly, I think we can agree in excluding something. The maddest proposal I've seen in this whole crisis of mad proposals was that by an American academic writing in The Guardian, who proposed an occupation of the whole of Serbia because the Serbs have lost all moral sense. I thought that really took some beating, and he showed no awareness whatever that there might be a little difficulty in occupying the whole of Serbia, and that maybe moral prudence, at least, would require some consideration of that. The question is really whether ground forces can be used either to establish some limited safe areas within Kosovo or to liberate the whole of Kosovo. And of course, associated with that is the question of whether the Kosovo Liberation Army, which is itself not innocent of activities pretty close to ethnic cleansing, should be supported, because after all, there is a ground war of sorts going on in Kosovo as we speak, and is being supported to some extent by NATO air power. Now, for what it is worth, and it's my own guess, and I claim no great authority in saying this, I think that if there were a committed and impressive NATO threat of land action to occupy that area of Kosovo that separates it from Serbia and to trap the Yugoslav troops behind that corridor, it might have been able to achieve success. Might. I can't say it would, and I'm not enough of a military expert to give an idea of the possible cost. But I know that that view is held by quite a large number of military experts, including some who have responsibilities for thinking about such things in the present crisis. That's my guess. And I say that because although it is true that Serbia has long held plans for territorial defense, it's also true that the Serbs who would be defending Kosovo are not residents of Kosovo. Most of them have come in from Serbia. And Serbs notoriously do not much visit Kosovo. It's a place of enormous symbolic significance to them, but not a great deal of practical significance. And therefore, the idea that there would be the same prolonged territorial defense struggle there as there would be in Serbia proper seems to me to be not proven. I wouldn't rule it out, but I would say that it is not proven. And add to that the fact that in a number of crises, including the crisis in the Krajina in 1995, the Serbs, who blustered and said they would fight to the last man, did not do so when faced with a direct assault. I would not rule out the possibility that land operation in Kosovo could have succeeded. The only thing I would put as a PS to that is I think now, having made such a mess of the start of the campaign and having bombed the Chinese embassy, about as crass a thing as it is conceivable to imagine, I think the chances of getting agreement among the governments of NATO to that action are not very great.
John Cockle from LSE. I wanted to ask you a question about whether or not the current events apart from their pros or cons, lay a basis for us to reinterpret certain elements of international law concerning human rights. And specifically, what I'm thinking of here are the is Article 1 of the 1966 Human Rights Covenants, which refers to the right of people to self-determination, and the 1970 Declaration on Friendly Relations, which upholds the norm of non-intervention with reference to that right, but only for governments that are, in the words of the 1970 Declaration, only for governments representing the whole people belonging to the territory without distinction as to race, creed, or color. My question is, do these events in Kosovo now in any way change our interpretation of the relationship between governance, self-determination, human rights, and intervention in the current climate? Can we understand them as laying a basis for a change in interpretation of those aspects of international human rights law? Thank you.
I think when a crisis is only halfway through, it's very difficult to see what wisdom people will see in it after it's over. But I would be skeptical as to whether one would see any fundamental reinterpretation of such basic provisions of international legal agreements as those which you properly cited. In particular, I think one that you cited, the really contentious one, Article 1 of the two UN Human Rights Covenants, which proclaims the right of self-determination, that right is in any case under very extensive reconsideration. There have been numerous statements, including in a UN context, in the 1990s, to the effect that the right of self-determination cannot be absolute, a case that every people that claims a grievance can set up their own state. And that's a recipe for endless conflict. And there's been a tendency, if one can summarize a large and complex debate in a simple and necessarily crude formula, there's been a tendency to conclude that the right of self-determination has to be interpreted above all as a right to democracy rather than as a right to statehood. But even that conclusion has caveats that are so patently obvious that I shan't elaborate them here.
Betty Scharf, United Nations Association. At a very recent meeting of the UN Commission on Human Rights, it was resolved that human rights monitors, UN human rights monitors, should try and enter Kosovo. I just wonder whether the lecturer could tell us whether any progress on this has been made, whether Milosevic has turned it down or is arguing about it, and whether, if such human rights monitors were admitted, it would allow some beginnings of the sort of Helsinki model that he has suggested as a general principle of dealing with the undoubted dilemmas of human rights and military intervention. I don't know whether such monitors have been admitted. Mary Robinson herself has also spoken as if it was a possibility.
It's clearly a possibility as part of a settlement. I would be very doubtful whether it's a possibility while the Serb campaign of ethnic cleansing, which is ruthless and determined, is continuing, because Milosevic cannot want observers watching all of that. Further, there are obvious risks for those monitors, and in my view, it was not completely senseless of the Western powers to withdraw the monitors from Kosovo before the military action began. Had they stayed there, there would have been a high risk of them being taken hostage, indeed probably a virtual certainty. And that would have been one other awkward element in the witch's cauldron of difficulties over Kosovo. So I think that all the diplomatic focus will be on trying to get an overall settlement. And there are, of course, possibilities for it, not least, because in a number of statements in the last few days, including today, Milosevic has implied that the major phase of ethnic cleansing, used of course another term, is over, and therefore that he can now envisage some kind of settlement. And so the possibilities will be there, and the argument will be very tough about the kind of international presence which will both monitor what goes on but also provide reassurance to the refugees to return. And those negotiations, I think one can assume, will go on for quite some time, because the two sides do approach them with completely conflicting ideas as to what kind of presence might satisfy the needs of the hour. And incidentally, I do think it's highly likely that the UN will have a role in such a presence, in legitimizing it, perhaps in organizing some aspects of it, because that would enable both sides to climb down from the rather exposed positions onto which they have got.
Vatsyanani Velasi. Excuse me, sir, I have just one question. What are, to your opinion, the moral or other grounds behind the refusal to arm the fighters of Kosovo Liberation Army by NATO?
The strongest argument against, and it's not one that I personally find persuasive now in the light of all that's happened, is that if you flood arms into a situation such as that of Kosovo and put them in the hands of, as it were, unauthorized groups and individuals, you risk getting an Afghan situation. And it flows from that, that if you're concerned that Kosovo might desire to change the borders in that region of the Balkans in one way or another, for example, by joining Albania or by incorporating Albanian areas in Macedonia or whatever, you would worry about the arming of the KLA. I personally think that it's high time there were some serious negotiations with the KLA, because perhaps they are going on, who knows, with a view to working out a practical relationship and with a view to supporting aspects of our struggle. But it is not an easy dilemma. And as I've indicated, one of the moral concerns about the KLA, apart from all the rumors that are circulated, which may or may not have any basis in fact, but I've read them as well, one of the basis of concern is that there is a risk that the KLA itself terrorizing Serbs out of Kosovo. And the argument is that an international presence is needed with some element of disarmament with Kosovo, within Kosovo, in order to calm the situation down. So those, I think, are the considerations that enter into the minds of statesmen. They're not ones that I would find very persuasive to if I was a KLA fighter.
M. Nelson. I'm Nelson Jobim, Brazilian journalist. Today, the UN envoy, Mr. Yasushi Akashi, said that Mr. Milosevic is ready to accept a light, small light armored force. And this afternoon, the Yugoslav news agents, Tanjug, announced that they have started to withdraw troops from Kosovo. Do you think that this is these are signs that they are that NATO is about to win the war, or they are satisfied with ethnic cleansing and are ready to compromise?
As I indicated, I think the Serb withdrawal today, such as the announcement, I should say, of a possible Serb withdrawal today, and the statement to Yasushi Akashi about willing to accept some UN monitors or whatever, doesn't in itself provide much reassurance. It might simply be evidence that the ethnic cleansing is regarded as complete. On the other hand, it must be an interest of Milosevic, other things being equal, to bring to a successful conclusion what he's been doing and to reach some accommodation with NATO. And so there could be elements of both those factors that you describe in what he's done today. But I can't say I'm optimistic about those statements, and on their own, they don't go very far towards meeting the G8 requirements.
I'm John from the Department of IR. Recently, Madam Robinson has said that both the Serb forces and the NATO forces will be subjected to war crime investigations, though to to different degrees of seriousness. I think this question has to do with collateral damage, which you have not talked a lot in your presentation. So my question is, what's your comment on her suggestion, and what's your comment on the concept of collateral damage? Because one of the victims of the bombing of NATO and the Chinese embassy is a female correspondent, and the last sentence that she has ever that she sent to her headquarters, the news agency in China, is that when would NATO stop such accidental mistakes? And unfortunately, it's paradoxical that you know, several days later, she herself was killed in such a bombing, and NATO again explained that it was an accident. So my question is, how much more accidental you know, mistakes like that could be allowed before the rule of collateral damage is breached? Thank you.
Mary Robinson's statement today wasn't quite what you said. It was that the NATO operations were subject to consideration by the War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague. I don't think she said they were actually being investigated, nor did she actually say they necessarily should at this instant be investigating, but the general principle is completely unexceptionable. There is no question about it, that it is within the remit of the War Crimes Tribunal. And so that gets to your second question, which is your critical one. At what point does all this accidental collateral damage become a war crime? And I have to say that, at risk of sounding like Jamie Shea, which I don't wish to do, that on the whole, it's clear that there has been a considerable attempt to bomb accurately, and granted the scale of the bombing, most of that effort has been reasonably successful. But the failures that there have been extremely serious, and they have arisen not because of some pure accident in some cases, but because of carelessness, perhaps, in the case of the Chinese embassy. Who knows, the extraordinary shoddiness of using several-year-old maps and not checking them against new maps is an example of extreme carelessness. And in some other instances, the so-called collateral damage may be due to the fact that pilots were operating from such very great heights and having to act without the chance to see exactly what they were hitting. Likewise with the attack on the convoy of refugees within Kosovo. And the question of when carelessness in planning or saving your own skin by operating from 15,000 feet, knowing that you are increasing the risk very substantially by so doing, the question of when that becomes an offence is an extremely difficult one, but and I wouldn't like to rush into an answer. There's a great deal in 1977 Geneva Protocol 1 about accuracy in targeting. Britain became a party to that last year, and it put in a reservation on that very issue of the methods of targeting, because it was recognised that it was extremely complicated and difficult. And so I'm afraid I simply can't give you a flip answer, but I feel the same way as you do, that there's something wrong with the inevitable endless parade of apologies, and it's almost become like London Transport regrets and the IRA regrets. It's now NATO regrets.
My name is Hadi Jamaldeen. You said that sometimes military action can make the situation worse. In this situation, it is my view that NATO should have acted now not now, long time ago. By taking this inadequate, insufficient military action, do you think NATO has worsened the human catastrophe in Kosovo? Thank you.
On the point about whether NATO could or should have acted a long time ago, it is extremely difficult to get a large shambling alliance to agree to a difficult action within a sovereign state, which is what is at stake here. And especially when that sovereign state is one that has a serious level of armaments. And although it's always possible to say that action should have been taken earlier, it's very hard to say confidently at what particular moment action should have been taken. And in my view, the main fault was not the failure to take military action sooner. One can argue that, Toss, and I'm not saying it shouldn't, but it's not clear to me when it should have been taken earlier. In my view, the very serious failure, but an understandable one, was the failure to include Kosovo in the Dayton negotiations. Everybody knew that Kosovo was a serious problem. Everybody knew that, as George Robertson has said, Milosevic is a serial ethnic cleanser. Everybody knew that it was unlikely that the Kosovars would maintain their non-violent policy, which they pursued heroically for many years, faced with Serb pressure. And the non-inclusion of Kosovo in the Dayton negotiations really made a statement to Kosovars that you only get into such negotiations if you fight. You only get considered in them if you fight. And so that, if I have to say when a fault was, that was it. On the question of whether the present military action has made things worse, regretfully, because I, as you will have gathered, support the aims that they were trying to achieve, I think probably it has. And I think there are times in life when it is necessary to make a situation worse in order to make it better. You may go through a period of extreme crisis in order to achieve a better result. And we have to remember that the whole of the final solution of the Jewish problem occurred during the Second World War. We can't claim to have prevented it by going to war. The situation was made worse in the short run in order to achieve a better result in the end. The problem here is that it is not clear that there is a strategy for a better result in the end.
I did promise our speaker that at 7:30 I would allow him to have a real drink. I'm going to take two last questions, one up there and the second one, the lady on the right. So can you ask your question, and if you don't mind, Adam, will you answer them together?
Sure. Sir John Estre, LSE, up in the balcony. Hi. I'd like to press you a little bit more to perhaps suggest a solution, propose a solution to everyone for this crisis. And I'd like to phrase it in this way. If you were Prime Minister Blair, or if you were President Clinton, or another head of state of one of the NATO nations, what would be your short-term priorities now, and what decisions would you make, and why? Thank you.
Lynn Welshman from SOAS. Without wishing to also force the gift of prophecy on you, in terms of future understanding of what the basis of this war has been, given that you've said there's no very, very clear legal position at the moment, and you alluded already to one very obvious regional example where UN resolutions have been consistently not enforced, largely also through the veto of one permanent member, as it was not possible in this case to get the agreement because of permanent members. How in the future will it be possible to argue that what applies now in one region, simply because it's NATO saying we should be allowed to bomb, in this case, because it's not our veto, how could that be applied? Well, I think you get my question. In terms of the future, how will this stand as a precedent or not if other regions apply the same logic, what undoubtedly does apply in other cases that exist Now, what do you think the states and Britain will say to other states who try to use the same arguments in different situations?
On the first one, it's obvious that I think a terrible mistake was made in making threats that weren't seriously thought out over Kosovo in the first place. So if I had the slightest choice in the matter or had the slightest influence in it, I wouldn't be starting from here, but we are starting from here, and I have to give you as best an answer as I can. If I were in Blair's or Clinton's shoes, God help me, I would take the negotiating track very seriously now. I would not step up the bombing. I would give extreme rigorous orders about every any further targets that were attacked having to be checked 5 or 6 times before they go ahead with them. Would aim for a solution under United Nations auspices in which some NATO forces would take part and which would be somewhat more than a standard peacekeeping force. And I think that's going to be about the best that can be hoped for. And on that basis, the forces that did go in would have to be aware that they were in for a long time. And that would be on the broad basis of the G8 proposals. And I think if I did go down that track, I would accept that it might take a month or more to get to any kind of closure with Milosevic on that set of proposals. That's not a very good answer. There are other side issues that might be pursued, including the need for a very full and open investigation of what on earth went wrong in the Chinese embassy attack, and a full accounting of that in all its detail to China. There's a lot else that needs to be done along similar lines. As regards Lynn Welshman's very apropos question, I personally am not convinced that people are going to learn an awful lot from this crisis about how to change UN procedures or anything like that. I don't think that this crisis is exactly going to be an advertisement for do-it-yourself military action when the Security Council can't agree, because it has involved such heavy costs for those engaging in the action as well as for those on the receiving end. And so I'd be sceptical as to whether vast lessons will be learned from it. One thing I do think is that it often happens in international relations that those who enter a crisis saying that they're going to teach someone else a lesson, and many of the statements that have been made by Western statesmen, including Madeleine Albright and Robin Cook, have had that hectoring tone of teaching Milosevic a lesson. One thing I do know about international relations is that when people start using that language, they usually end up learning a lesson themselves. And I think that that may be what's going to happen in this case. On the veto, I think we are stuck with the veto. There's no way that those who at present wield the veto are going to abandon it, especially not after this crisis. Russia and China will clearly value their wielding of the veto in this crisis, their capacity to use it, and likewise some Western powers may value their capacity to use the veto against Russia and China on occasion. So I think we're going to be stuck with the UN still having central responsibility for international security, but not a complete monopoly of action or authorization of action.
Adam, I think that the fact that the applause precedes my publicly thanking you is a good indication to you of how much the audience has appreciated your very comprehensive and extremely sensitive dealing with an issue which has many people in anguish on both sides of the question. I'd like to thank you very much again on all our behalfs, and also to point out to those who have invitations that the reception is in the Shaw Library on the 6th floor of this building. Thank you, Adam. Another round of applause.